A bill to deal with police use of force in California has stalled. And that new bail reform law Governor Brown signed is already getting pushback. California lawmakers have an end-of-session deadline tomorrow night. On Insight, we'll highlight some of the issues that might get through to the governor's desk. This is his last end-of-session as governor. It's a transition, too, for our state government reporter Ben Bradford. He'll join me to explain in his final Capitol chat. The man behind the Earth Biogenome Project is here today. He is Dr. Harris Lewin. Earlier this year, he and his team announced a plan to map the DNA of every living organism on the planet. We'll learn what's happened since then. Writer Steve Almond is back with more bad stories. That's the title of his latest book. And later, Nick Bruner joins me for this week's Sound Advice. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's coming up today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. You probably know that Governor Brown signed a first-of-its-kind bail reform law this week, ending cash bail in California. The effort to overturn that law is already underway. Meanwhile, the police use of force bill that came after the Stephon Clark shooting has been stopped for the time being. This is Governor Brown's final session as governor, and the session ends tomorrow night at midnight, so it's crunch time. Cap Radio state government reporter Ben Bradford is with me for this week's Capitol Chat. Hi, Ben.
Hi there.
So what's happening with the police shooting bill? Is it right to say it failed, or is stalled a more technically correct term?
I think that either of those is fine. The fact of the matter is that the Senate leader, Democratic Senate leader Tony Atkins, announced late last night that it is not going to pass this session. So it's shelved. It failed. It didn't happen. Now, what she said is that a, quote, critical problem remains unaddressed. And she said that basically there just wasn't enough time to figure out a compromise agreement that was going to be acceptable to law enforcement and also be acceptable to civil liberties advocates. And, you know, this use of force bill came out. It was introduced just a few weeks after the Stephon Clark shooting in Sacramento.
Right.
And so this was a major push to change a state law that has not changed since the 1800s. The California use of force law goes back that far.
And that only happened back in March. So we're talking a couple months.
Yeah.
But is this an idea that just hasn't reached its time yet? It'll be returned and revisited next session?
Well, so that's what Atkins says. She says that they're going to introduce a bill in January. But, you know, I will say that the law enforcement lobby is one of the most influential and most powerful at the state capitol. And it's hard to see, they typically push back against changes to their conduct. So a good example of that would be a slew of different bills involving body cameras. Now, there's a body camera bill moving forward this year so far that I have not been covering to the same extent. But over the last few years, we saw many efforts to dictate how both the footage from body cameras get used and also just when they have to be turned on and what are the policies around that. And those have almost completely failed to pass in any kind of forms that dictate to police agencies. So then when you get to an issue like use of force and when an officer can fire their gun or use deadly force, you can see how it's difficult to even put in place regulations on body cameras. It gets even thornier when you get to that very divisive issue.
Let me move to another interesting issue. There's a bill that passed that relates to accomplices in crime, and I found some of this fascinating.
So the bill says that murder convictions only apply to people who are, the actual killer or, say, someone who hired them or knew a murder was going to occur and helped it occur. And that's a change to what's called the felony murder rule. And what that is the felony murder rule says that if someone is participating in another felony, like, so let's say, a robbery, and their accomplice kills someone in the course of it, then everyone involved in the robbery is guilty of murder. So you know, critics of the rule say people can be incidental to a crime, you know, not even there for it, with no knowledge that someone intends to kill someone else, and then end up in prison for life or on death row.
And isn't there a profile of the typical accomplice or a common profile of accomplices?
One of the stats that we've seen from some civil liberties groups is that if you look at women who are in prison for murder, the stat that was discussed last night is that more than 70% are from the felony murder rule, and their average age is 20. Yeah, exactly.
And their average age is 20.
Yeah.
All right. So that one passed last night. That one's still on the move.
Yeah, it's going over to the Senate now and then to Governor Brown if it passes there.
Let's talk about bail reform. Jerry Brown dealt with prison overcrowding in California as a major issue in these last two terms, particularly in the third term. So was this bail reform effort in the mix of approaches that he's been talking about and considering for a number of years?
You know, so it's interesting. Brown has been critical of the bail system even since his first stint as governor, but more about the injustice of being able to get out of jail based on how much money you have and having to owe money for not having enough money, right? I mean, people who go to a bail bondsman typically have to pay about 10% of that loan even if they're found not guilty. So he's been critical of that for decades. You know, there has been a push in California, partially in response to a court order finding California's prisons unconstitutionally overcrowded,
right,
to reduce that overcrowding. Certainly, the advocates on the civil liberties side, the opponents of bail on the civil liberties side, had initially pushed for this bill as a way of reducing the number of people being held in pretrial detention. We also saw, you know, many of those supporters, including, for instance, the ACLU and Human Rights Watch, split away because they're not convinced that under the final version of the bill that will happen. So the overcrowding issue, I think, is one that interplays with bail.
Not necessarily a direct connection.
Exactly, yeah.
All right. I understand what you're saying. And by the way, the governor did sign that into law, the end of the cash bail system in California. It is historic for the state. It's historic for the country. There is not yet a review system that would be required for it to be put into practice yet. Meanwhile, there's already pushback. There's already a retaliation effort.
So the bail industry, I mean, this is an existential threat to the bail industry, right? I mean, without bail, what are they going to do? And so they have already announced that they're going to push a referendum. They're going to do everything that they can to overturn it. If they can get the signatures and they can qualify a referendum, it'll freeze the law's implementation, although the law is already not supposed to go into effect. The new bail system's not supposed to start until October of next year. But as you said, there is a risk assessment system that's supposed to replace the bail system, and the Judicial Council, which is a part of the administration of the courts, is still working through exactly what that would look like. And then counties would have to impose their own. So there's a lot of infrastructure that would have to go into place in a relatively short time.
In the meantime, nothing changes until all of that is in place.
Right.
Right. All right. Lawmakers are tackling a lot of issues. Let's move to SB 100, a bill that might not be on anybody's radar, but is significant for a number of reasons.
Well, you know, this is the fourth big climate change bill that we've seen in 4 years in the legislature. You know, we saw going back to 2015, one of the first significant bills that I covered was SB 350, which raised the state's renewable energy goals, making it 50% in 2030. And doing a whole bunch of other climate change related things. We saw last year the extension of the cap and trade system. Before that, we saw just an increase of the amount of greenhouse gases the state wants to remove from the air and the goal for doing that, which encompasses more than just the electric sector. So this year we saw and in the last few days, actually yesterday, we saw this go to the governor, SB 100, which is a bill that actually raises that renewable energy standard, the amount of electricity that our utilities have to get from renewable energy, raises it again. They raised it in 2015 to 50% in 2030. Now they're raising it to 60% in 2030. And then longer term from that, it says that state agencies have to start planning and pursuing 100% zero emission electricity by 2045. So by mid-century, get completely off of carbon emitting electric generation. And the only reason I say carbon emitting and, you know, zero emission rather than renewable energy is because there are some complicated things in there. For instance, the state has a lot of hydropower, which we don't typically count as renewables, even though, of course, you know, it is renewable. And then also the bill would allow for instance, carbon capture technologies, which really are not cost effective yet.
All right. So that's going to the governor, to be signed.
Well, no, that's interesting.
I know. We don't usually predict, but I think under the umbrella of climate change.
Well, you would think that, except that last year when I was in China with the governor and we were discussing this bill, he was first on stage at a climate change summit and refused to comment on it one way or the other. And then I asked him about it afterward, and he had this kind of wishy-washy statement.
I think that's good, but I don't want to minimize now. Our 2030 goals are quite daunting. How do we get to about 265 million tons of greenhouse gases when we're at 430 or thereabouts?
I don't want to minimize now. He sounds like the parent who's saying, well, do good on this, and then we'll give you that next responsibility.
Yeah. And you know, it's an interesting question. I mean, I don't think that people doubt the most of the scientists that I've talked to don't doubt the ability of utilities to continue to ramp up their renewable energy. I mean, they're pretty much on track to first they're going to hit the 2020 goals, and then it ramps up from there to go from a third renewable energy.
So is he just addressing the pace of it?
Well, it is the pace, but it's also this idea that, you know, California has so much renewable energy at this point that there are certain times where we have so much coming in and we're not using enough electricity that the state actually has to sell energy, not sell. They pay other states to take our energy, right? So if you just keep putting on more renewables, the question is, you know, what do you do about that? And the idea is that technologies can continue to account for that as time goes on. But what if they don't? So it's just putting that whole puzzle together.
All right. I'm talking with Cap Radio state government reporter Ben Bradford, joining me for this week's Capital Chat. In fact, the last time that he'll be joining us for a Capital Chat, because just as the governor is in his final session of his final time in the governor's office, you're here just for a number of hours, maybe through the end of session tomorrow, because you've taken a new job and it's a new national job. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, definitely bittersweet. I've really loved living in Sacramento and, you know, covering the Capitol. It's just a fascinating experience. But yeah, it's exciting. I'm going to be moving over to, you'll hear me on Marketplace.
We'll still hear you on NPR. And I think it's interesting that you worked in politics in Washington. You covered politics in North Carolina and now in California. But Marketplace is a broad business show. So how do you think your experience and your knowledge might inform what you'll be doing next?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. So, you know, on one hand, I have done business coverage before when I was in New York, and also when I was in North Carolina, I did some business coverage. But just beyond that, I just think that, you know, I'm fascinated by this country, influence and power and how it shapes how we live our lives. And I think that there are two big levers on that, right? One is politics and the other is business. And so it'll be interesting to switch over. And of course, I'm not going to forget the interplay. You know, we've been talking today about, you know, the bail industry, right? And just how that affects, you know, and we're talking about campaigns, we're talking about money, talking about the law enforcement lobby, how much money goes to lawmakers in addition to just the, you know, the public pressure that they can exert. So that doesn't go away simply because I'm covering business. It's still there, just through a different lens.
Well, you've had some remarkable assignments while you've been here at Cap Radio, including a trip with the governor to China.
Right. Yeah.
A little bit of sparring in the back seat with him about the word legacy. And you had a visit with him to some pandas.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we just heard a little bit of tape from when we were in China. We asked him about that bill a year ago. And the China trip, though, the pandas had to be just the most surreal experience. You know, you're there. We were still jet lagged. We'd been in the country for probably 24 hours at that point. And here we are at the world's largest, essentially kind of like zoo for pandas. And I'm there with Jerry Brown, who is kind of, you know, looking around and just not at all impressed.
So they sit around a lot. Well, in the wild, they have to keep moving, don't they?
You know, and later on, he was like, yeah, they're cute. They kind of remind me of my dog, Calusa. And it was just weird. I mean, it was this weird, it ended up being this kind of blip in this, you know, trip that otherwise involved all of these, you know, elaborate state visits. And that actually was an elaborate state visit because, of course, the pandas are very protected. And Brown and two of California's top energy regulators, the head of the Air Resources Board and the Energy Commission, all went in. They had to like wear scrubs to go and hold a baby panda. And their whole entourage, you know, I like snuck in for a second and I got kicked out. The whole entourage got kicked out. People were saying like, oh, this could be an international incident. You guys have to get out of this room.
And so, in the atmosphere of pandas where virtually every person in the world would go, oh, look at that. Even you would. And it's just so funny to think about how does Jerry Brown react to that? And his comment was, they sit around a lot.
Yep, that's absolutely right.
All right, so you're on to the new job as of next week?
Well, I'll start there next month. And in the meantime, I have to move to Los Angeles wrap up here. And
I can't let you go without asking for a prediction, because you're just about off the clock here. Where do you think we might see Jerry Brown next?
Oh, I think that's such an interesting question. You know, he is still the UN's special advisor. He has an official role with the UN as their sort of ambassador for states and regions on climate change. I think we've seen this be his defining issue as governor. I don't expect that we'll see that stopping. On the other hand, you know, it's just interesting what happens when people lose their main hold on power. We saw that, you know, SB 100, which we were talking about earlier today, the Senate leader, Kevin De Leon, that's his bill. And it went from him pushing it through to all of a sudden he was no longer the head of the Senate. And you heard a lot of talk about it. There was definitely some score settling in the assembly with people not voting for it. So that'll be interesting to see. But Brown, even though he says he's going to go retire to his farm in Colusa County, his ranch in Colusa County, he still has millions of dollars in a campaign war chest, and that's right. Not just going to sit there.
Well, thank you. You've been an excellent reporter, really terrific to work with, a fun personality in the newsroom, and everybody wishes you the best. We'll look forward to hearing you on Marketplace.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben. You can find more information online at capradio.org/insight. And by the way, as we go to break, you're going to hear music by Ben Bradford's brother, who has visited us on the entertainment side of things. So here you go. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In the science world, the announcement about the Earth Biogenome Project couldn't have been bigger. A team of researchers led by Dr. Harris Lewin planned to map the DNA of every living organism on Earth, and to do it, they think, in about 10 years. A moonshot for biology, Dr. Lewin has called it. He is professor of evolution and ecology at UC Davis. It's not easy to get a window of time with him, but he's here today to update us on the biogenome work. Welcome. It's really wonderful to have you in the studio.
Good morning, Beth. It's a pleasure to be here.
Would you tell me about the range of reaction to your announcement?
Yeah, the range is just completely all over the map. You know, the first reaction is typically great skepticism. Then moves to, wow, this really is possible, to great enthusiasm. And finally, you know, how can we help? How can we participate?
Will this be the biggest scientific study that's ever happened?
It'll be the biggest scientific study in biology that's ever happened in terms of, you know, the number of people involved and the cost. The Human Genome Project cost about $3 billion back in, you know, in about 1990, in the 1990s, and inflation-adjusted dollars today, that's about $5 billion. Our project will come in at less than that. So imagine that we could sequence every organism on the planet, all eukaryotic organisms, those with a nucleus, for less than the cost of just sequencing the human genome 25 years ago.
That speaks to the changes in technology and costs, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes. There have been tremendous advances in DNA sequencing technology. We say that the cost of sequencing has come down like the inverse of Moore's law, you know, in computing. And, you know, today we're at about a millionth of the cost of sequencing a base of DNA as we were when I started sequencing as an assistant professor back in the 1980s.
Wow. That's phenomenal, but that isn't the only key to why it's doable, right?
That is the major technological advance that allows us to even can think about sequencing all organisms. The second is the advances in computing, because this is a really big data project. It'll be the biggest data set ever generated, including astronomical data sets. We now say, we like to say that this is a genomical amount of data, not an astronomical amount of data.
Genomical amount. Let's talk about the scope of that. Just for comparison, how many species on Earth have been fully sequenced so far?
Yeah, to date, 2,500 of the 1.5 million known eukaryotic species have had their genome sequenced. So that's less than 0.2% of all known eukaryotic species on the planet. So all of our knowledge about, you know, in biology, the genomic basis for many of the traits are derived from, you know, less than 0.2% of what's there. So just imagine what we're going to learn from the other 99.8%.
Are you only targeting known species at this point, or are you assuming that you're going to uncover and discover something new in the process?
Well, we have two strategies. One is to target the known species, but the other strategy is to sample deep into existing ecosystems. And by doing that, we're going to discover new species practically without even trying. They're there. We just don't know what's there. We don't know what we don't know.
I love that phrase. I mean, that's all about the questions that we have on Earth, right?
Right.
Let's get back to the Human Genome Project, which you mentioned, and whether your work has been influenced by that and became a template for what you'll do.
The Human Genome Project really was the, you know, the template for all of genome projects that followed. There have been many genome projects. The ones that I was involved in early on, in the early at the turn of the millennium, was the bovine genome project, the cattle genome project, and as well as the swine genome project, and then several others. As it became cheaper and cheaper, we just began to churn out more genomes for the kinds of analysis that we wanted to do. But the Human Genome Project set many examples of collaborative interactions among very large laboratories, both in the United States and around the world. And without that international collaboration, the Human Genome Project would have never been completed. And so it is really a template for what we're trying to do with the Earth Biogenome Project, because we have now about 30 laboratories in 6 countries that have signed up to our project. Mm. And that number is growing on a monthly basis.
So when you were talking about reaction in the beginning to, wow, this really can be done and how can I help, you're looking for lab partners then. You're also looking for funding partners, funding support.
We're looking for large international research organizations in countries where there's a large amount of biodiversity that exists, because many countries do not want to send their biodiversity outside of their country because they believe that the biodiversity is a resource for potential economic development. So they would like to develop the infrastructure within those countries to do this kind of work. So yes, we are working with many different organizations, large and small, in different countries to sign them up to the project. But we also have a strong public component to what we would like to do. To collect 1.5 million species, which is one of the major bottlenecks of the project, we need to involve more than just the scientific community. We need to engage the public. And we're doing that in California in a project, which is the California chapter of the Earth Biogenome Project, through what we call bioblitzes, where the public gets engaged with scientists, and they go out in the field and they're able to collect, document, and voucher specimens that will be eventually used for the sequencing.
I know you just piqued someone's interest out there. So how or when is that happening here? And if we post a link to the Biogenome Project, do people find out information that way?
Yeah, there's a website for the Earth Biogenome Project. It's www.earthbiogenome.org. And there's going to be information posted there periodically as the project progresses. The official launch of the project is November 1st in London, in England, which is going to be sponsored by the Wellcome Trust. And then after that, the individual projects that will contribute to the Earth Biogenome Project will be seeking support, of course, for not just financial support, but the support for these bioblitzes where the public will engage and go out and participate in the collection and analysis of the genome sequences from all of life that's on our planet.
You are listening to Dr. Harris Lewin. He is Distinguished Professor of Evolution and Ecology at the UC Davis College of Biological Sciences. He's also Distinguished Professor of Population Health and Reproduction in the School of Veterinary Medicine. You said the official launch is November, but is work already beginning?
Yes, the work has been going on for the past three to five years. The seeds of this project were planted back in 2009 with a group of scientists that got together to sequence 10,000 vertebrate genomes. Vertebrates are those with a backbone, right?
That was the same time as your work on the dairy cow.
That's right. And we were involved in we already began to think about how we could scale up, because so many important things were being discovered both in the agricultural organisms, plants and animals, as well as in organisms that are important in our environment. That it was clear that we needed to start to scale up so that we can capture the maximum amount of new knowledge and new applications from what's already here on our planet. People think that it's this is expensive at $4.7 billion, but over 10 years. But think about that. That's $470 million a year globally. It's not very much. And then you think about some of the other big science projects. I'll give you one example, the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, which was important for the discovery of the Higgs boson.
Right.
That project, just the discovery of the Higgs boson cost $13.2 billion, and the facility has a $1 billion a year operating budget. And I like to ask my students and others, you know, what has the Higgs boson done for you lately? I can tell you what the human genome has done, and the cattle genome and the chicken genome and swine genome, all of those have, yielded tremendously important scientific and commercial advances. And so this project, you know, in terms of its scale, the number of people and the outcomes that we expect is going to be very important in the everyday lives of every person on the planet.
When you were talking earlier about countries and how they do or don't want to share their biodiversity in shipping it, moving it to other labs, I was thinking about that concept of biology property or genomic property, and that your work is going to reach into policy, into health discoveries, even into pharmaceutical and marketing eventually. Is your team looking at all of that and where it might go, or do you just focus on the plan you have, which is over the next 10 years to do the collection?
Yes, we have a very large interdisciplinary team that's looking at all aspects of this, including the intellectual property aspects and what we call access and benefit sharing provisions under the Convention for Biological Diversity, Nagoya Protocols, which we have pledged. Every institution that is signing up to the Earth Biogenome Project has agreed to abide by the Nagoya Protocols, which ensures benefit sharing to those countries and those communities that contribute biodiversity to the project, from which some potential commercial product or application might derive. So we have really been thinking about this. We have a relatively large group that's engaged in this. And in fact, the World Economic Forum is sponsoring an entire group within the World Economic Forum called the Earth Bank of Codes, which is developing new technologies like blockchain technology to control the access to the data and make sure that those that are accessing the data will be abiding by the Nagoya protocols. So we are really taking that issue very seriously, because if we don't, you know, I like to say if there's no access, there's no benefit. And if there's no benefit, there will not be any access.
Well, I hope this is the beginning of a continuing dialogue that we'll have as you make discoveries along the way. I am interested in whether realistically there will ever be an end date. I know 10 years is your initial time frame, but truly, this work could go on forever.
That's right. Well, we hope not forever, but the 1.5 million species we really think we can do in 10 years. The real issue is that there's probably another 10 million species that we don't know about. And so in 10 years from now, when we complete the 1.5 million and I'm back on your show and you're going to ask me, well, what are you going to do now? I'm going to say, we'll be planning to do the next 10 million.
And I'm going to say, remember when I used the word forever? That's the part I was talking about.
By then, it'll be so inexpensive, we'll probably be able to
Isn't
do it
that
all
something?
In just,
you know,
a few years.
Wow. Well, thanks again for making time for us today, and I look forward to our next conversation.
My pleasure, Besh. Thanks for the invitation.
That is Dr. Harris Lewin, professor of evolution and ecology at UC Davis and the leader of the Earth Biogenome Project. We will post that link. There will be more information and some linked stories as well at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In April, when Steve Almond was here to talk about his new book, Bad Stories, our conversation ranged from politics to parenting to navigating tense conversations that can happen now in these political times between loved ones. Steve is the co-host of the advice podcast Dear Sugars with Cheryl Strayed, and he's a deep thinker, and he writes in that voice that he thinks and ponders with. So I asked him to come back when he was in the area again, and here he is.
Yeah, good to be here.
Thank you so much for returning. What bad stories are weighing on you lately that aren't in the political realm? And I ask that only because I see that you are a very strong voice about the conflict of the politics of our time.
Yeah, I think the central bad story that I encounter, having put Bad Stories, the book, into the world, is that people are really engaged in a struggle with faith, is what I think it is. Ultimately, I didn't realize I was writing a book about faith, but I think that's the kind of book I wrote, because running underneath all of the distractions of the news cycle, of everything that is coming at us, is a basic question, I think, that a lot of citizens of good faith have, which is, do I matter? Does my individual voice and action matter in this great experiment of self-government? Mm. And I think the last election is great evidence that, you know, 104 million people didn't think their voice mattered enough to get to the polls. That was way more than either candidate. And now we're coming up on a midterm where I think the issues are pretty clear. If you're a citizen of good faith, you have to vote if you want personal interests to be put before corporate interests. And, you know, that's not a political statement. It's more a statement of faith. Do you believe that it matters? And so I felt increasingly that the real struggle underneath everything is for individual citizens to somehow be reacquainted with their faith and the idea that their individual actions matter. Because at every moment in the American story where America has risen up and made a huge moral shift, where the pendulum is swung the other way, whether it's abolition or suffrage or civil rights, at any moment, it's been because a whole bunch of individual citizens believed that their political action made a difference. And the stories that undercut that are the ones that break my heart.
Hmm. Because do I matter can lean to great depth and depression. to sadness.
That's
and
right.
Sort of a paralysis.
Yep.
And at some point, maybe that can force anger, which gets people to rise up.
Yeah. Well, the way I say it in Bad Stories is that human beings, as a rule, and we see this, I see this in my work with Dear Sugars as well, with Cheryl, human beings have a tendency, and Americans have a bad habit of exalting their grievances as a way of really defending themselves against their vulnerabilities. And this is not a partisan statement. I think every human being, I don't believe in bad people. I think people fall under the influence of bad stories, and not just people on this side of the political divide or that side of the political divide. In fact, all of us are struggling with the question of whether we matter in the course of the democracy, whether we're the subjects of history or just the objects of history. And I think it's reached a kind of crisis point, and the midterm election, although lots of people sit that election out, is really an inflection point. It's going to be a question. And I say this not because, I mean, I obviously always want human interest to come before corporate interests. I'm deeply troubled by the way in which I feel, this is my belief, our government, at least at the federal level, has kind of devolved into a kleptocracy. There's just rampant corruption. There's an alliance between big government and big business in a way that is, to me, unprecedented. When I look at the number of cabinet secretaries who simply view public service as a for-profit endeavor. And one of the things that's quite sad about the way that, and I again, I say this with all due respect because I think you make a deep effort to go deep into issues. I know that from having listened to the show. The media gets lost in a stimulation game. And so the latest story, which basically begins, like almost every headline, the president hates thus and such a person or entity, those stories, which are bad stories, which teach us nothing new, we just affirms what we already knew and kind of stokes our tribal grievance, blots out a whole bunch of really good and important stories, such as, for instance, you were discussing earlier in the hour, the fact that the California lawmakers are considering really, you know, putting it to the metal in terms of saying we are going to have only renewable electricity by 2045. The federal government be damned. This is what California, the fifth largest economy in the world, is going to do, because we have to fight the reality of climate change. Or my senator, from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, just proposed an anti-corruption act that is the most morally grounded, commonsensical way to drain the swamp. It just says we shouldn't have a government in which lawmakers can become lobbyists, in which corporate influence is rampant. It's very basic in terms of what it wants to do. It really basically wants to drain the swamp. And those stories, it's not that we don't hear about them. They do get some coverage, but the dominant drumbeat of coverage is an incessant focus on conflict, grievance, this one sad, insecure man's grudge against the world.
Well, I want to skip over that then. I really want to go back to your intriguing very first question,
yeah,
which is, do I matter? And then the follow-up to me, or one of the follow-ups, is how do I find out if I matter?
Right.
How do I know? Where do I go to know? Because maybe the typical institutions that used to feed me back a picture of myself,
right,
either aren't there or aren't an accurate reflection or aren't reliable anymore.
Right. Right.
So what are people doing?
Well, I can't. It's interesting because I wrote a book that was a book of ideas that was trying to say, here, if you're worried about all these bad outcomes, you have to trace them back to the bad stories that we've been telling ourselves or consenting to. I viewed it as a book about ideas, but what I realized when I would read from Bad Stories is that people are struggling with this question you just identified. How do I know that I matter in this era of sort of social media, the kind of curated life, this kind of vast echo chamber where all and everything seems to cast me as just a consumer of entertainment? Can I actually then stand up and get off my couch? And if I go into the streets, what do I do? What sign do I hold up? You know, what candidate or cause do I support? And what I always try to say to, readers or people who come to a reading is you need to ask yourself the question, what candidates or causes are important to me? If you've got three little kids, as I do, then public education should matter to you. And then you should align yourself with a candidate. More teachers are running for office. I mean, look what just happened in Oklahoma. Again, you don't hear a lot about it in the midst of the president's infantile tweet storm, but there is a kind of movement happening in this country, not in the blue states, but in the red states, right? West Virginia, Arizona, Oklahoma, where teachers, the people who educate our young, are rising up and saying, I do not consent to a society in which I do not have a livable wage. You know,
that's what I think is coming out of this, Steve. And I say that from sitting in this seat on this show, where I get such a cross-section of people involved in so many topics, is the lack of being able to use something bigger to define is making people go in small ways to what they care about. And maybe for the first time, getting out, joining in, going to see something, my friend Corey going back to college, somehow figuring out how to connect with another human being. And don't we all know that the getting out of oneself is the ultimate way to finding some purpose?
I think it's sort of like finding your tribe. We talk about this a lot on Dear Sugars. People, when they're sort of trapped within their own loop of bad stories, where the only thing they can do is sort of see a media that's casting America as some sort of horror movie, the dark other lurking, you know, the old con of getting people focused on racial resentment or ethnic resentment to distract them from economic justice. It dates back to before we were a country. Or they have a media that's telling them it's all a joke, everybody's corrupt, which is really preying on a certain kind of faithlessness. We laugh at it. We laugh at Sam B. or John Stewart. But it is predicated on the idea that they're all corrupt and there's nothing you can do about it but laugh so you don't cry.
Yeah.
But I feel like there is a kind of awakening that's happening in the country. And it's not happening in a huge top-down way. It's happening because individuals are saying, you know what? I do not consent to this arrangement where my only role is to passively tweet, sort of hate watch democracy's descent. For me individually, I thought, what do I have in the world? What can I do? Well, I do the work that I do on Dear Sugars, but that's very personal. I teach, that's not partisan. But as a citizen, I teach writing. And what I've done personally is say, I want to have a series of fundraising workshops where everybody who comes has to contribute, not to me, but to a candidate or cause that they support. I don't care what it is. I just want them to be involved and activated as citizens. And when they come and before we talk about writing and do all that stuff, they're incredibly excited because they say, you know, there is this organization that's specifically about trying to empower families that are torn apart at the border or you know, people who are seeking refuge in this country or dot, dot, dot. Mm-hmm. And once they realize they're not alone and that there are a whole bunch of other people who have quietly been, if you know what I mean, suffering with that feeling of, I can't do anything about this.
Stuck.
Exactly. Once they take action and connect with that larger network, a little bit of their faith is renewed. But what you were saying before, Beth, is really important. It's difficult for people to shoulder the burden of hope. When they really are idealistic and they believe that they can make a difference, I think about all the people on every losing candidate, you know, and every losing campaign, Republican, Democrat, Independent. Somebody wins. And somebody loses. And all those people who work so hard and their candidate lost, it's hard to maintain faith when you've really been disappointed. But it's also the only way that change gets made. It doesn't happen all at once. Rosa Parks doesn't stand up and suddenly there's a civil rights movement. It's the individual action standing up and saying, I am going to be a subject of history, not an object of history.
Thank you for coming by to give us a small presentation today, because these are the conversations that I love having. You're so good at, and I think Bad Stories has become much more organic maybe than anybody anticipated, and it continues living on. Are you writing another book right now?
I am writing a book. It's a book about a novel that I love, and it's about the inner life, because I think it's all related. Our political circumstances arises from our inner life.
All right. Well, next time you're passing through Sacramento, the door's open. The seat's there. The mic is there. Okay?
I shall be here.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Steve Allman's latest book is Bad Stories. He is the co-host of the podcast Dear Sugars. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. This week's sound advice is a mix of new releases, I think. And in the studio with me is Nick Bruner, host of Hey Listen, which airs Saturday nights on CAP Radio.
Yeah, that's pretty much the ethos of my show. New releases, I think,
it might be. It's such an easy go-to for you.
Well, hi.
Hi. Glad to have you here.
Mm-hmm.
You want to begin with something that seems to fit well, once in a lifetime.
Oh, my gosh. So this is from Angelique Kidjo. She covers the entire 1980 Talking Heads album, Remain in Light. So this record When it came out in 1980, it already incorporated Afrobeat influences, but Angelique Kidjo just takes it all the way. I love the Talking Heads. I thought I could go another 37 years without hearing Once in a Lifetime ever again. But then Rosemary Welsh, I mean, I like it, right? But I don't like seek it out necessarily. Rosemary Welsh from WYEP in Pittsburgh, she submitted this track to NPR's Heavy Rotation, and then my ears were just reborn.
And you may ask yourself, what is that beautiful house? And you may ask yourself, where does that highway go to? And you may ask yourself, am I right, am I wrong? And you said to yourself, my God, what have I done? Letting the days go by. Letting the days go by.
Do you have to go any further? Can we just sit here and enjoy that for the next 8 minutes?
No, if you want, you just pot the whole thing back up and that's it. Another sound advice in the books.
Fabulous. We need that. We need more of that. We need that in the newsroom, I think.
Oh my gosh. And then definitely go check out that video too if you ever want to shake off the doldrums of office life. It's just a huge smile came to my face when listening to that for the first time.
Okay, great start. Let's keep going.
Okay, this next band is called Fantastic Furniture. It's by Julia Jacklin. She fronts it. She's an Australian songwriter. Her solo work is usually a little more demure, a little less aggressive than what we get with Fantastic Furniture. This track is called Dark Corner of the Dance Floor.
The voice. Nice, like, little warm blanket edge there.
This band has been described as the project of old friends who wanted to shake the shackles of their, quote, meticulously crafted solo work and experience a second giddy adolescence. Mm. I can hear that.
All right. You're listening to Nick Bruner. This is this week's Sound Advice.
And the next track we have comes from a New York trio called Wild Pink. It's the title track from their new album, Yolk in the Fur.
Was it the voice or the kind of instrumental mood that you liked?
It's the whole thing, really. Like, I like a good ponderous track, and Yolk in the Fur has all the trappings, but it opens up in a nice big way after about the first minute and a half, 2 minutes, and it becomes speedier, but not overly aggressive. It's just, I don't know, you mentioned warmth the last track that we heard, and this one just wraps me up. I love it to death. Again, that's the title track to Yolk in the Fur by Wild Pink.
I just imagine you having music everywhere you go in your life, that music is always with you. Is that true?
Yeah, it's a gigantic burden, Beth. I don't mind telling you. Really. I mean, we get so much stuff submitted to us for Hey Listen and for just general consideration here at Cap Radio. It's impossible to get through everything. So, just slog away.
I think the place I feel for you is that you really love it as a soundtrack of your life, but then it's your job, so it demands a lot of you, too. So.
Yeah, I think you pretty much hit it on the head there.
All right. Let's hear some more good music then.
Oh my gosh. So this is great. So this is by a group called Shanty Darling. It's fronted by Chanticleer True, a man out of Portland, Oregon. He's a Renaissance man. He has a background in music and theater and dance and drag and cabaret. He was even on my favorite album by this musician called Jolie Holland, which sounds nothing like what we're about to hear. And this is just electro soul inspired by his mother's favorite artists.
Chain around my neck, but I couldn't stand. I sank from all the you left behind for me to clean up. You nasty, and you're wrong for that. Speaking of the mess, swept under the rug, but then it's so hard to ignore to see the blood down on the floor. Easy to slip and bust my ass again.
I want to see him now. I like the way he sounds, but now I want to see him.
So can you hear like Prince and Evelyn Champagne King, maybe some Sade, some Morris Day in there?
I definitely get some 80s music in there, definitely. But it's not, it's newer than that too.
And what I love about this is that he does, it's not played for laughs. It's not like some kind of, oh, I'm trying not to laugh, wasn't this so dumb back in the day kind of
exactly.
thing. He loves this music and it comes through across the entire record. The album is called R&B Volume 1 by Shanti Darling.
This has been a great Sound Advice. Thank you so much. What are you up to next? Do you have a show Saturday?
Absolutely. Got a show I'm still putting together on Saturday. Trying to sift through a couple of in-studio performances by some groups. Looking to the future as to who else to book in the meantime. So.
You're great help to us on Insight Music, too. I'll thank you publicly here for all the times that you step in when we need your help.
My pleasure.
And we're going to close with more great music. Thank you, Nick. That's this week's Sound Advice. You can find more music at capradio.org/insight. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruriak. Be sure to hear Nick Bruner Saturday nights on Cap Radio. The program is Hey Listen. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today, thank you very much, Anthony Van Hook. And Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.